Carl Marlantes was a Rhodes Scholar and a decorated Marine who was awarded the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, and 2 Purple Hearts. His novel, Matterhorn, won numerous awards and was a bestseller. But back in 1969, Marlantes was dropped into the middle of a jungle in Vietnam. At the age of 23, he was put in charge of the lives of 40 other young men. He was not psychologically or spiritually prepared for that, and for what came after the war. Marlantes writes about the experience in his book, What It Is Like to Go to War.
It was about 2 days before Christmas, and I had been on top of a very tall mountain and had been left there with just a platoon to cover a whole company's front. And we were exhausted, and we were trying to do the work of a company, pretending to be a company, and we'd gotten hit a couple of times, and I'd lost 3 people to a terrible friendly fire incident. And this was the first time I was actually in command all by myself of a fire base and the platoon, because the company had left. So this was really my sort of first initiation into combat. And it was just before Christmas. And so I thought I'd read you a bit about what happened on that day. 2 days before Christmas, the fog lifted just enough to allow a single chopper to work its way up to us, a dangerous journey, squeezing beneath the cloud ceiling just a few feet above the jungle-covered ridges. Along with food, water, mail, and ammunition came the battalion chaplain. He had brought with him several bottles of Southern Comfort and some new dirty jokes. I accepted the Southern Comfort, thanked him, laughed at the jokes, and had a drink with him. Merry Christmas. Inside, I was seething. I thought I'd gone a little nuts. How could I be angry with a guy who had just put his life at risk to cheer me up? And didn't the Southern Comfort feel good on that rain-raked mountaintop? Years later, I understood. I was engaged in killing and maybe being killed. I felt responsible for the lives and deaths of my companions. I was struggling with a situation approaching the sacred in its terror and contact with the infinite, and he was trying to numb me to it. I needed help with the existential terror of my own death and responsibility for the death of others, enemies and friends, not Southern Comfort. I needed a spiritual guide.
You know, what's compelling about that paragraph that you just read is what it leads to, the mm-hmm. discussion that it leads to in What It Is Like to Go to War, your book. Because of the suggestion that war is a spiritual experience and you need a spiritual guide.
Right. I know most people are aghast when I mention that thesis, but the first thing about it is that what is spiritual experience about? What are religions about other than death? If we didn't die, I don't think we would probably do much of that sort of activity. And here you are, you have a 19-year-old who has been raised in a basically Judeo-Christian culture, thou shalt not kill, and they're all decent kids, and that they believe it firmly. And then suddenly they are transported, usually to some foreign country, and asked to kill for their country, which is totally the opposite of everything that they've ever done. And like I say, it's when you kill another human being and you sort of wake up to the fact, which usually happens after you do it, you don't just have a wound to your body or your psyche from the war, you actually have a wound to your soul. And looking at warfare, because it does deal with death, and 19-year-olds cast in the role of the gods, only the gods really should be the ones deciding who lives and who dies. And yet, you know, 19-year-old squad leaders have to tell a kid, you're on point today, and maybe he dies. Or we take the life of other people in combat, or even sacrificing your own life, which is the Christian God.
It seems to me that you're suggesting that our soldiers might be healthier if we not only talked about it, but had a more, well, for lack of a better word, a crueler introduction to what was going to be asked of them.
Yes, I wouldn't use the word cruel. I would use the word darker. It's this world of opposites that we definitely live in, light and dark. And accepting that both are part of of life, part of the spiritual experience, is important, because you're going to ask these kids to go into the dark side. And if they've never had anybody even talk to them about it, the 19-year-old isn't going to, you know, be enlightened and go into combat, sort of like our ideal of the samurai soldier or something. But if you can tell him ahead of time, you're going to experience this, you're going to think about this, this is going to happen to you after you come back. It may not happen the first week. It may happen a decade later. But to sort of give them the warning signs of what they're going to face, they will recognize it faster. And I dealt with PTSD for 4 decades. If someone had told me what was coming down the road, I would have probably recognized it 20 years earlier, saved a lot of problems.
Well, and what you're talking about is training that sounds harsh,
yeah,
but you're talking about two periods in a soldier's life, man or woman,
mm-hmm,
the in-combat
right
time and the post
right
war career time. The PTSD,
yeah,
is something that everybody is aware of, but again, hardly anybody talks about
right
now.
Yeah. No, it's
and
it's
you think
brutal.
that training before going into combat, being more aware,
mm-hmm,
will both help you kill,
mm-hmm,
and help you survive the killing?
I don't think it'll help you kill. I think that the way that you kill is that you don't want to take another human life. So the way that we sort of trick ourselves in combat is that we sort of get into the mental state that person that you're about to kill is actually not a person. You know, words like gook, towelhead, ragtop, damn Yankee, you name them, and nigger, Jew. We have all these things in our culture that allows us to make the other person a, you know, non-human. I call it pseudo-speciating. It's a big word, but basically it's just what it allows you to do is pull the trigger on somebody who at that moment you don't really think is human, because if it was human, you would hesitate and it would be much harder. I had an experience where this broke down, and that haunted me some 20 years after the war.
You talk about this in the book.
I do.
You can still remember looking into the eyes,
eyes of a
man who was as scared as you were.
Exactly. And we happened to just be no more than about 10 or 15 feet apart. And he had been throwing grenades at me and my friends and had wounded badly one of my friends. And we were throwing them back and had killed one of his friends who was in the hole. And I had snuck up on the side so I could get a shot at him to stop this. And I was looking at him right across the barrel of the M16. And he stood up with the hand grenade already ready to pull the primer. And we locked eyes. And that's very unusual. And I kept saying to myself, and I was whispering out loud, I wish I could speak Vietnamese. Don't throw it. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. Don't throw it. If you don't pull it, I won't pull the trigger. I did not want to do that. He just snarled at me and threw it, and I pulled the trigger. 20 years later, I mean, I was busy that day. I mean, that just went right out of my mind as soon as that was. In fact, I talk in the book, I felt bad because I bucked my shot and hit the dirt in front of him instead of a clean shot. I mean, weird thoughts. But 20 years later, I'm driving down I-5, you know, 2 a.m, country music on the radio, a nice little bubble of warmth in the car, and those two eyes appeared in the windshield.
How old were you?
At that point, I was probably, 45.
How old were you when you took the shot?
23.
And you'd been in country?
Yeah.
For a while.
Oh, yeah. I'd been in country for a while.
This wasn't a fresh
meeting. No. This was where I said that it broke down. Because when you're generally, certainly in jungle warfare, you hardly ever see who you're shooting at. And even if you're just a couple meters away, I mean, it's really thick foliage. And they're, of course, trying to hide.
Yeah.
Which you are trying to do, too. But it was at this moment that it broke down. I saw those eyes. And then it was my unconscious saying, Marlanus, you got to deal with this. And that was a large impetus for writing this book.
Well, and this is the thing when you come home, when you stop being a soldier,
right,
or even if you stay in the Army but you're no longer in combat,
right,
that you have to deal with. All that time when you took the emotion out of it in order to do your job,
mm-hmm,
in order to make it a job instead of a passion. It sounds as though that comes roaring back once you're out of the zone. The emotion comes pouring back in. It's almost as though you have to experience all of that emotion that you kept out.
Yeah, I don't know if you have to. I did. I mean, writing this book, I mean, I you know, I mean, I'd have snot on the keyboard from bawling my eyes out because of trying to sort of, I mean, it would come roaring out. And I suspect that that is the way it works. You can't get the job done if you're completely in the throes of an emotional state. That's not going to work. And so you cut it off. But on the other hand, you still are a human being and you have experienced this. And in order to integrate it without damage to yourself, you do have to start to feel it, because the way that a lot of people take care of it, which we need to watch for in our culture, is numbing through alcohol, drugs, suicide. It's a good way to stop feeling things. So that's why it's important, again, that you tell the young soldier that it's going to be okay. You're going to feel this, but that's good. This is called getting through it, not, oh, you're terrible. You're breaking down. And we have a lot of that problem. I mean, the current military has a problem. Guys are afraid to go in and get help for PTSD because if it says unstable on their record, they're not going to get a promotion. So, I mean, it's very hard. I think there's a definite debate going on in the military now. It's the other side is coming up, and I think will eventually work its way through and succeed.
So what do we do? Can you train soldiers ahead of time to know? You talk about needing a spiritual guide.
Yeah.
That's where we started this conversation.
Sure.
You need a spiritual guide.
I think that you
What kind of spirit guide can
First of all,
what you need to get out of this?
Well, you don't need a priest in liturgical garments. I think there are simple things that you can do that will help you retain your humanity and your connection to the spirit. That, for example, if you could just train corpsmen, who are sort of the big brothers. I mean, because they have to do an extra bit of training, medics, they're usually older than the others. And you give them just a little training of how do you handle the grief of losing a friend? How do you bury the enemy? We used to throw them off the sides of the hill. And I had this one moment where I look back on it, I went, two guys in my platoon had, we'd been under attack for days, and he'd lost a lot of friends. And the dead were just down right below our fighting holes. And they had gone down and cut the ears off. Okay, they're like 18, 19 years old. It's like Letterman sweater stuff. And I had been in combat in country a long time, and I wasn't angry with them, but I knew you couldn't let that go. And so I just said, look, I know they killed your friends. You killed their friends, and you killed them. And I said, this is nothing that you should get trophies over. And so I said, I want them buried. And so I told those kids to go down and bury those two bodies. And that wasn't trivial because we were still taking sniper fire. And they went down, dug that hole, and they both started crying because they realized that they had done something over the top. And that, I'm sure, moved them forward to being able to reintegrate back into normal society because they touched what their humanity was on the spot. They didn't make them any less effective Marines. Believe me, I know those two guys. That night we were hit again, they were doing just the same job that they would have before.
But maybe because they had their grief then.
Exactly.
They didn't have to have it 5 years later.
Or 20 years later. They didn't have to be even afraid to let it come out.
Carl Marlantis, speaking about his book, What It Is Like to Go to War. He's also the author of the award-winning, best-selling novel, Matterhorn.